Teddy Runkleman has been attending to this discussion like a spectator at a tennis final. Perry Brown says, "Let's handle first things first. What do you intend to do with this man and his friends? Are you going to charge them? The sight of his face is getting on my nerves." Dale thinks for a moment, then says, "I'm not going to charge them. Get out of here, Runkleman." Teddy moves backward, and Dale says, "Hold it for a second. How did you get here?"
"The back road," Teddy says, "comes straight down from behind Goltz's. Thunder Five came the same way. So did that big shot reporter, Mr. Green."
"Wendell Green is here?" Teddy points to the side of the ruin. Dale glances over his shoulder, and Jack looks in the same direction and witnesses Beezer St. Pierre ripping film from the back of a camera while Wendell Green watches in dismay. "One more question," Dale says. "How did you learn that the Freneau girl's body was out here?"
"They was 5 or 6 bodies up at Ed's is what I heard. My brother Erland called up and told me. He heard it from his girlfriend."
"Go on, get out of here," Dale says. And Teddy Runkleman ambles away as if he has been awarded a medal for good citizenship. "All right," Perry Brown says. "Chief Gilbertson, you have reached the end of your leash. As of now, this investigation is to be conducted by Lieutenant Black and myself. I'll want a copy of the 911 tape and copies of all notes and statements taken by you and your officers. Your role is to be entirely subordinate to the state's investigation and to cooperate fully when called upon. You will be given updates at the discretion of Lieutenant Black and myself. If you ask me, Chief Gilbertson, you are getting far more than you deserve. I have never seen a more disorganized crime scene. You violated the security of this site to an unbelievable degree. How many of you walked into the structure?"
"3, Dale says. "Myself, Officer Dulac, and Lieutenant Sawyer."
"Lieutenant Sawyer," Brown says. "Excuse me, has Lieutenant Sawyer rejoined the LAPD? Has he become an official member of your department? And if not, why did you give him access to that structure? In fact, what is Mr. Sawyer doing here in the first place?"
"He's cleared more homicide cases than you and me ever will, no matter how long we live."
Brown gives Jack an evil glance, and Jeff Black stares straight ahead. Beyond the two state cops, Arnold Hrabowski also glances at Jack Sawyer, though not at all the way Perry Brown did. Arnold's expression is that of a man who deeply wishes to be invisible, and when he finds Jack's eye on him, he quickly glances sideways and shifts on his feet.
"Oh," Jack thinks. "Of course. The mad, 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 mad Hungarian. There you go."
Perry Brown asks Dale what Mr. St. Pierre and his friends are doing on the scene, and Dale replies that they are assisting with crowd control. Did Dale advise Mr. St. Pierre that in exchange for this service, he would be kept up to date on the investigation? It was something like that, yes. Jack steps back and begins to move sideways along a gentle arc that will bring him to Arnold Hrabowski.
"Incredible," says Brown. "Tell me, Chief Gilbertson, did you decide to delay a little bit before passing the news on to Lieutenant Black and myself?"
"I did everything according to procedure," Dale says. In answer to the next question, he says that yes, he has called for the medical examiner and the evidence wagon, which, by the way, he can see coming up the lane right now. The mad Hungarian's efforts at self-control succeed only in making him look as though he urgently needs to urinate. When Jack places a hand on his shoulder, he stiffens like a cigar store Indian.
"Calm down, Arnold," Jack says, then raises his voice.
"Lieutenant Black, if you're taking over this case, there's some information you should have."
Brown and Black turn their attention to him. "The man who made the 911 call used the payphone at the 7-Eleven store on Highway 35 in French Landing. Dale had the phone taped off, and the owner knows to keep people from handling it. You might get some useful prints from that phone."
Black scribbles something in his notebook, and Brown says, "Gentlemen, I think your role is finished here. Chief, use your people to disperse those individuals at the bottom of the lane. By the time the ME and I come out of that structure, I don't want to see a single person down there, including you and your officers. You'll get a call later in the week if I have any new information."
Wordlessly, Dale turns away and points Bobby Dulac down the path, where the crowd has dwindled to a few stubborn souls leaning against their cars. Brown and Black shake hands with the medical examiner and confer with the specialists in charge of the evidence wagon.
"Now, Arnold," Jack says, "you like being a cop, don't you?"
"Me? I love being a cop."
Arnold cannot quite force himself to meet Jack's eyes.
And I could be a good one, I know I could, but the chief doesn't have enough faith in me.
He thrusts his trembling hands into his pants pockets. Jack is torn between feeling pity for this pathetic wannabe and the impulse to kick him all the way down to the end of the lane. A good cop? Arnold couldn't even be a good scoutmaster. Thanks to him, Dale Gilbertson got a public dressing down that probably made him feel as though he'd been put in the stocks.
But you didn't follow orders, did you, Arnold?
Arnold quivers like a tree struck by lightning.
What? I didn't do anything.
You told someone. Maybe you told a couple of people.
No! Arnold shakes his head violently. I just called my wife, that's all.
He looks imploringly at Jack.
The fisherman talked to me. He told me where he put the girl's body, and I wanted Paula to know. Honest, Lieutenant Sawyer, I didn't think she'd call anybody. I just wanted to tell her.
Bad move, Arnold, Jack says. You are going to tell the chief what you did, and you're going to do it right now. Because Dale deserves to know what went wrong, and he shouldn't have to blame himself. You like Dale, don't you?
The chief?
Arnold's voice wobbles with respect for his chief.
Sure I do. He's great. But isn't he going to fire me?
That's up to him, Arnold, Jack says. If you ask me, you deserve it. But maybe you'll get lucky. The mad Hungarian shuffles off toward Dale. Jack watches their conversation for a second, then walks past them to the side of the old store, where Beezer St. Pierre and Wendell Green face each other in unhappy silence.
Hello, Mr. St. Pierre, he says, and hello to you, Wendell.
I'm lodging a complaint, Green says. I'm covering the biggest story of my life, and this lout spoils a whole roll of film. You can't treat the press that way. We have a right to photograph whatever the hell we like.
I guess you would have said you had a right to photograph my daughter's dead body, too.
Beezer glares at Jack.
This piece of shit paid Teddy and the other lunkheads to go nuts so nobody would notice him sneaking inside there. He took pictures of the girl.
Wendell jabs a finger at Jack's chest.
He has no proof of that. But I'll tell you something, Sawyer, I did get pictures of you. You were concealing evidence in the back of your truck, and I got you dead to rights. So think twice before you try to mess with me, because I'll hang you out to dry.
A dangerous red mist seems to fill Jack's head. Were you going to sell photographs of that girl's body?
What's it to you?
An ugly smirk widens Wendell Green's mouth.
You're not exactly lily white either, are you? Maybe we can do each other some good, huh?
The red mist darkens and fills Jack's eyes.
We can do each other some good?
Standing beside Jack, Beezer St. Pierre clenches and unclenches his enormous fists. Beezer, Jack knows, catches his tone perfectly, but the vision of dollar signs has so gripped Wendell Green that he hears Jack's threat as a straightforward question.
You let me reload my camera and get the pictures I need, and I keep quiet about you.
Beezer lowers his head and balls his hands again.
Tell you what, I'm a generous guy. Maybe I could even cut you in, say 10% of my total.
Jack would prefer to break his nose, but he contents himself with a hard punch to the reporter's stomach. Green clutches his gut and folds in half, then falls to the ground. His face has turned a hectic pink, and he struggles for breath. His eyes register shock and disbelief.
See, I'm a generous guy too, Wendell. I probably saved you thousands of dollars in dental work, plus a broken jaw.
Don't forget the plastic surgery, says Beezer, grinding a fist into the palm of the other hand. He looks as if someone just stole his favorite dessert off the dinner table.
Wendell's face has become a reddish shade of purple.
For your information, Wendell, no matter what you think you saw, I am not concealing evidence. If anything, I am revealing it, though I hardly expect you to understand.
Green manages to wheeze in something like a cubic inch of air.
When your wind starts to come back, get out of here. Crawl if you have to. Go back to your car and drive away. And for God's sake, make it snappy, or our friend here is likely to put you in a wheelchair for the rest of your life.
Beezer leans over and whispers, "How'd you like to be dead from the neck down?" Slowly, Wendell Green gets to his knees, takes another noisy sip of oxygen, and levers himself upright. He waggles one open hand at them, but his meaning is unclear. He could be telling Beezer and Jack to stay away from him. or that he will trouble them no further, or both. His trunk tilted over his belt, his hands pressed to his stomach, Green stumbles around the side of the building.
"I guess I ought to thank you," Beezer says. "You let me keep my promise to my old lady. But I have to say, Wendell Green is one guy I'd really like to deconstruct."
"Man," Jack says, "I wasn't sure if I could get in before you did."
"It's true, my restraint was crumbling."
Both men smile. "Beezer St. Pierre," Beezer says, and sticks out a hand. "Jack Sawyer." Jack takes his hand and experiences no more than a second of pain.
"Are you gonna let the state guys do all the work, or will you keep going on your own?"
"What do you think?" Jack says.
"If you ever need any help, or you want reinforcements, all you have to do is ask. Because I do want to get this son of a bitch, and I figure you have a better chance of finding him than anyone else."
On the drive back to Norway Valley, Henry says, "Oh, Wendell took a picture of the body, all right. When you came out of the building and went to your truck, I heard someone take a couple of pictures, but I thought it might have been Dale. Then I heard it again when you and Dale were inside with Bobby Dulac, and I realized someone was taking a picture of me. Well, now, I say to myself, this must be Mr. Wendell Green, and I told him to come out from behind the wall. That's when those people charged out, yelling and screaming. As soon as that happened, I heard Mr. Green trot around from the side, go into the building, and shoot a few pictures. Then he sneaked out and stood by the side of the building, which is where your friend Beezer caught up with him and took care of things. Beezer is a remarkable fellow, isn't he? Henry, were you going to tell me about this?"
"Of course, but you were running around all over the place, and I knew Wendell Green wasn't going to leave until he was thrown out. I'll never read another word he writes. Never."
"Same here," Jack says.
"But you're not giving up on the fisherman, are you, in spite of what that pompous state cop said?"
"I can't give up now. To tell you the truth, I think those waking dreams I mentioned yesterday were connected to this case."
"Ivy divey.
Now let's get back to Beezer. Didn't I hear him say he wanted to deconstruct Wendell?"
"Yeah, I think so."
"He must be a fascinating man. I gather from my nephew that the Thunder Five spend Saturday afternoons and evenings in the Sand Bar. Next week, maybe I'll start up Rhoda's old car and drive to Centralia, have a few beers and a nice gab with Mr. St. Pierre. I'm sure he has interesting taste in music."
"You want to drive to Centralia?" Jack stares at Henry, whose only concession to the absurdity of this suggestion is a little smile.
"Blind people can drive perfectly well," Henry says. "Probably they can drive better than most sighted people. Ray Charles can, anyhow."
"Come on, Henry. Why would you think Ray Charles can drive a car?"
"Why, you ask? Because one night in Seattle, this was, 40 years ago, back when I had a gig at KIRO, Ray took me out for a spin. Smooth as Lady Godiva's backside. No trouble at all. We stuck to the side roads, of course, but Ray got up to 55, I'm pretty sure."
"Assuming this really happened, weren't you scared?"
"Scared? Of course not. I was his navigator. I certainly don't think I'd have a problem navigating to Centralia along this sleepy stretch of backcountry highway. The only reason blind people don't drive is that other people won't let them. It's a power issue. They want us to stay marginalized. Beezer St. Pierre would understand perfectly."
"And here I was, thinking I was going to visit the madhouse this afternoon," Jack says.
Chapter 14. At the top of the steep hill between Norway Valley and Arden, the zigzag hairpin turns of Highway 93, now narrow to two lanes, straighten out for the long ski-slope descent into the town. And on the eastern side of the highway, the hilltop widens into a grassy plateau. Two weather-beaten red picnic tables wait for those who choose to stop for a few minutes and appreciate the spectacular view. A patchwork of quilted farms stretches out over 15 miles of gentle landscape, not quite flat, threaded with streams and country roads. A solid row of bumpy blue-green hills form the horizon. In the immense sky, sun-washed white clouds hang like fresh laundry. Fred Marshall steers his Ford Explorer onto the gravel shoulder, comes to a halt, and says,
Let me show you something. When he climbed into the Explorer at his farmhouse, Jack was carrying a slightly worn black leather briefcase, and the case is now lying flat across his knees. Jack's father's initials, PSS, for Philip Stevenson Sawyer, are stamped in gold beside the handle at the top of the case. Fred has glanced curiously at the briefcase a couple of times, but has not asked about it, and Jack has volunteered nothing. There will be time for show-and-tell, Jack thinks, after he talks to Judy Marshall. Fred gets out of the car, and Jack slides his father's old briefcase behind his legs and props it against the seat before he follows the other man across the pliant grass. When they reach the first of the picnic tables, Fred gestures toward the landscape.
We don't have a lot of what you could call tourist attractions around here, but this is pretty good, isn't it?
It's very beautiful, Jack says. But I think everything here is beautiful.
Judy really likes this view. Whenever we go over to Arden on a decent day, she has to stop here and get out of the car, relax, and look around for a while. You know, sort of store up on the important things before getting back into the grind. Me, sometimes I get impatient and think, come on, you've seen that view 1,000 times. I have to get back to work. But I'm a guy, right? So every time we turn in here and sit down for a few minutes, I realize my wife knows more than I do, and I should just listen to what she says.
Jack smiles and sits down at the bench, waiting for the rest of it. Since picking him up, Fred Marshall has spoken only 2 or 3 sentences of gratitude, but it is clear that he has chosen this place to get something off his chest.
I went over to the hospital this morning, and she... Well, she's different. To look at her, to talk to her, you'd have to say she's in much better shape than yesterday. Even though she's still worried sick about Tyler, it's... different. Do you think that could be due to the medication? I don't even know what they're giving her.
Can you have a normal conversation with her?
From time to time, yeah. For instance, this morning she was telling me about a story in yesterday's paper on a little girl from La Riviere who nearly took 3rd place in the statewide spelling bee, except she couldn't spell this crazy word nobody ever heard of. Papaplax or something like that.
A papanax, Jack says. He sounds like he has a fishbone caught in his throat.
You saw that story, too?
That's interesting, you both picking up on that word. Kind of gave her a kick. She asked the nurses to find out what it meant, and one of them looked it up in a couple of dictionaries. Couldn't find it. Jack had found the word in his concise Oxford dictionary. Its literal meaning was unimportant.
That's probably the definition of a papanax, Jack says. 1, a word not to be found in the dictionary. 2, a fearful mystery.
Ha! Fred Marshall has been moving nervously around the lookout area, and now he stations himself beside Jack, whose upward glance finds the other man surveying the long panorama.
Maybe that is what it means.
Fred's eyes remain fixed on the landscape. He is still not quite ready, but he is making progress.
It was great to see her interested in something like that, a tiny little item in the Herald.
He wipes tears from his eyes and takes a step toward the horizon. When he turns around, he looks directly at Jack.
Before you meet Judy, I want to tell you a few things about her. Trouble is, I don't know how this is going to sound to you. Even to me, it sounds... I don't know.
Give it a try, Jack says.
Fred says, okay.
Knits his fingers together and bows his head. Then he looks up again, and his eyes are as vulnerable as a baby's.
Ah, I don't know how to put this. Okay, I'll just say it. With part of my brain, I think Judy knows something. Anyhow, I want to think that. On the other hand, I don't want to fool myself into believing that just because she seems to be better, she can't be crazy anymore. But I do want to believe that. Boy, oh boy, do I ever...
Believe that she knows something. The eerie feeling aroused by a papanax diminishes before this validation of his theory.
Something that isn't even real clear to her, Fred says. But do you remember? She knew Ty was gone even before I told her.
He gives Jack an anguished look and steps away. He knocks his fists together and stares at the ground. Another internal barrier topples before his need to explain his dilemma.
Okay, look, This is what you have to understand about Judy. She's a special person. All right, a lot of guys would say their wives are special, but Judy's special in a special way. First of all, she's sort of amazingly beautiful, but that's not even what I'm talking about. And she's tremendously brave, but that's not it either. It's like she's connected to something the rest of us can't even begin to understand. But can that be real? How crazy is that? Maybe when you're going crazy, at first you put up a big fight and get hysterical, and then you're too crazy to fight anymore, and you get all calm and accepting. I have to talk to her doctor, because this is tearing me apart.
What kinds of things does she say? Does she explain why she's so much calmer? Fred Marshall's eyes burn into Jack's.
Well, for one thing, Judy seems to think that Ty is still alive, and that you're the only person who can find him.
All right, Jack says, unwilling to say more until after he can speak to Judy. Tell me, does Judy ever mention someone she used to know, or a cousin of hers, or an old boyfriend she thinks might have taken him? His theory seems less convincing than it had in Henry Layden's ultra-rational, thoroughly bizarre kitchen. Fred Marshall's response weakens it further. Not unless he's named the Crimson King, or Gorg, or Abola. All I can tell you is Judy thinks she sees something, and even though it makes no sense, I sure as hell hope it's there.
A sudden vision of the world where he found a boy's brewer's cap pierces Jack Sawyer like a steel-tipped lance. And that's where Tyler is.
If part of me didn't think that might just possibly be true, I'd go out of my mind right here and now, Fred says. Unless I'm already out of my gourd.
Let's go talk to your wife, Jack says. From the outside, French County Lutheran Hospital resembles a 19th-century madhouse in the north of England. Dirty red brick walls with blackened buttresses and lancet arches, a peaked roof with finial-capped pinnacles, swollen turrets, miserly windows, and all of the long facade stippled black with ancient filth. Set within a walled parkland, dense with oaks on Arden's western boundary, the enormous building, Gothic, without the grandeur, looks punitive, devoid of mercy. Jack half expects to hear the shrieking organ music from a Vincent Price movie. They pass through a narrow, peaked wooden door and enter a reassuringly familiar lobby. A bored, uniformed man at a central desk directs visitors to the elevators. Stuffed animals and sprays of flowers fill the gift shop's window. Bath-robed patients, tethered to IV poles, occupy randomly placed tables with their families, and other patients perch on the chairs lined against the side walls. Two white-coated doctors confer in a corner. Far overhead, two dusty, ornate chandeliers distribute a soft ochre light that momentarily seems to gild the luxurious heads of the lilies arrayed in tall vases beside the entrance of the gift shop.
Wow, it sure looks better on the inside, Jack says.
Most of it does, Fred says.
They approach the man behind the desk, and Fred says, Ward D? With a mild flicker of interest, the man gives them two rectangular cards stamped visitor and waves them through. The elevator clanks down and admits them to a wood-paneled enclosure the size of a broom closet. Fred Marshall pushes the button marked 5, and the elevator shudders upward. The same soft, golden light pervades the comically tiny interior. 10 years ago, an elevator remarkably similar to this, though situated in a grand Paris hotel, had held Jack and a UCLA art history graduate student named Ileana Tedesco captive for 2.5 hours, in the course of which Ms. Tedesco announced that their relationship had reached its final destination, thank you, despite her gratitude for what had been, at least until that moment, a rewarding journey together. After thinking it over, Jack decides not to trouble Fred Marshall with this information. Better behaved than its French cousin, the elevator trembles to a stop and, with only a slight display of resistance, slides open its door and releases Jack Sawyer and Fred Marshall to the 5th floor, where the beautiful light seems a touch darker than in both the elevator and the lobby. Unfortunately, it's way over on the other side, Fred tells Jack. An apparently endless corridor yawns like an exercise in perspective off to their left, and Fred points the way with his finger.
They go through two big sets of double doors, past the corridor to Ward B, past two vast rooms lined with curtained cubicles, turn left again at the closed entrance to gerontology, down a long, long hallway lined with bulletin boards, past the opening to Ward C, then take an abrupt right at the men's and women's bathrooms, pass ambulatory ophthalmology and records annex, and at last come to a corridor marked Ward D. As they proceed, the light seems progressively to darken, the walls to contract, the windows to shrink. Shadows lurk in the corridor to Ward D, and a small pool of water glimmers on the floor. "We're in the oldest part of the building now," Fred says. "You must want to get Judy out of here as soon as possible." "Well, sure, as soon as Pat Scarter thinks she's ready. But you'll be surprised. Judy kind of likes it in here. I think it's helping. What she told me was she feels completely safe, and the ones that can talk, some of them are extremely interesting. It's like being on a cruise," she says. Jack laughs in surprise and disbelief, and Fred Marshall touches his shoulder and says, "Does that mean she's a lot better or a lot worse?" At the end of the corridor, they emerge directly into a good-sized room that seems to have been preserved unaltered for 100 years. Dark brown wainscoting rises 4 feet from the dark brown wooden floor. Far up in the gray wall to their right, two tall, narrow windows framed like paintings admit filtered gray light. A man seated behind a polished wooden counter pushes a button that unlocks a double-sized metal door with a Ward D sign and a small window of reinforced glass.
"You can go in, Mr. Marshall, but who is he?"
"His name is Jack Sawyer. He's here with me."
"Is he either a relative or a medical professional?"
"No, but my wife wants to see him."
"Wait here a moment."
The attendant disappears through the metal door and locks it behind him with a prison-like clang. A minute later, the attendant reappears with a nurse whose heavy, lined face, big arms and hands, and thick legs make her look like a man in drag. She introduces herself as Jane Bond, the head nurse of Ward D, a combination of words and circumstances that irresistibly suggest at least a couple of nicknames. The nurse subjects Fred and Jack, then only Jack, to a barrage of questions before she vanishes back behind the great door.
"Ward Bond," Jack says, unable not to.
"We call her Warden Bond," says the attendant. "She's tough, but on the other hand, she's unfair."
He coughs and stares up at the high windows.
"We got this orderly, calls her 00.
A few minutes later, head nurse Warden Bond, agent 00, swings open the metal door and says,
"You may enter now, but pay attention to what I say."
At first, the ward resembles a huge airport hangar, divided into a section with a row of padded benches, a section with round tables and plastic chairs, and a third section where two long tables are stacked with drawing paper, boxes of crayons, and watercolor sets. In the vast space, these furnishings look like dollhouse furniture. Here and there on the cement floor, painted a smooth, anonymous shade of gray, lie padded rectangular mats. 20 feet above the floor, small, barred windows punctuate the far wall, of red brick long ago given a couple of coats of white paint. In a glass enclosure to the left of the door, a nurse behind a desk looks up from a book. Far down to the right, well past the tables with art supplies, three locked metal doors open into worlds of their own. The sense of being in a hangar gradually yields to a sense of benign but inflexible imprisonment. A low hum of voices comes from the 20 to 30 men and women scattered throughout the enormous room. Only a very few of these men and women are talking to visible companions. They pace in circles, stand frozen in place, lie curled like infants on the mats. They count on their fingers and scribble in notebooks. They twitch, yawn, weep, stare into space and into themselves. Some of them wear green hospital robes, others civilian clothes of all kinds, T-shirts and shorts, sweatsuits, running outfits, ordinary shirts and slacks, jerseys and pants. No one wears a belt, and none of the shoes have laces.
Two muscular men with close-cropped hair and in brilliant white T-shirts sit at one of the round tables with the air of patient watchdogs. Jack tries to locate Judy Marshall, but he cannot pick her out.
"I asked for your attention, Mr. Sawyer."
"Sorry," Jack says. "I wasn't expecting it to be so big."
"We'd better be big, Mr. Sawyer. We serve an expanding population."
She waits for an acknowledgement of her significance, and Jack nods.
"Very well, I'm going to give you some basic ground rules. If you listen to what I say, your visit here will be as pleasant as possible for all of us. Don't stare at the patients, and don't be alarmed by what they say. Don't act as though you find anything they do or say unusual or distressing. Just be polite, and eventually they will leave you alone. If they ask you for things, do as you choose within reason. But please refrain from giving them money, any sharp objects, or edibles not previously cleared by one of the physicians. Some medications interact adversely with certain kinds of food. At some point, an elderly woman named Estelle Packard will probably come up to you and ask you if you are her father. Answer however you like, but if you say no, she will go away disappointed, and if you say yes, you'll make her day. Do you have any questions, Mr. Sawyer?"
"Where is Judy Marshall?"
"She's on this side, with her back to us on the farthest bench. Can you see her, Mr. Marshall?"
"I saw her right away," Fred says. "Have there been any changes since this morning?"
"Not as far as I know. Her admitting physician, Dr. Spiegelman, will be here in about half an hour, and he might have more information for you. Would you like me to take you and Mr. Sawyer to your wife, or would you prefer going by yourself?"
"We'll be fine," Fred Marshall says. "How long can we stay?"
"I'm giving you 15 minutes, 20 max. Judy is still in the eval stage, and I want to keep her stress level at a minimum. She looks pretty peaceful now, but she's also deeply disconnected, and quite frankly, delusional. I wouldn't be surprised by another hysterical episode, and we don't want to prolong her evaluation period by introducing new medication at this point, do we? So please, Mr. Marshall, keep the conversation stress-free, light, and positive."
"You think she's delusional?" Nurse Bond smiles pityingly.
"In all likelihood, Mr. Marshall, your wife has been delusional for years. Oh, she's managed to keep it hidden, but ideations like hers don't spring up overnight. Oh, no. These things take years to construct, and all the time the person can appear to be a normally functioning human being. Then something triggers the psychosis into full-blown expression. In this case, of course, it was your son's disappearance. By the way, I want to extend my sympathies to you at this time. What a terrible thing to have happened."
"Yes, it was," says Fred Marshall. "But Judy started acting strange even before..."
"Same thing, I'm afraid. She needed to be comforted, and her delusions, her delusional world, came into plain view, because that world provided exactly the comfort she needed. You must have heard some of it this morning, Mr. Marshall. Did your wife mention anything about going to other worlds?"
"Going to other worlds?" Jack asks, startled.
"A fairly typical schizophrenic ideation," Nurse Bond says. "More than half the people on this ward have similar fantasies."
"You think my wife is schizophrenic?" Nurse Bond looks past Fred to take a comprehensive inventory of the patients in her domain.
"I'm not a psychiatrist, Mr. Marshall, but I have had 20 long years of experience in dealing with the mentally ill. On the basis of that experience, I have to tell you, in my opinion, your wife manifests the classic symptoms of paranoid schizophrenia. I wish I had better news for you."
She glances back at Fred Marshall.
"Of course, Dr. Spiegelman will make the final diagnosis, and he will be able to answer all your questions, explain your treatment options, and so forth."
The smile she gives Jack seems to congeal the moment it appears.
"I always tell my new visitors it's tougher on the family than it is on the patient. Some of these people, they don't have a care in the world. Really, you almost have to envy them."
"Sure," Jack says. "Who wouldn't?"
"Go on, then," she says, with a trace of peevishness. "Enjoy your visit."
A number of heads turn as they walk slowly across the dusty wooden floor to the nearest row of benches.
Many pairs of eyes track their progress. Curiosity, indifference, confusion, suspicion, pleasure, and an impersonal anger show in the pallid faces. To Jack, it seems as though every patient on the ward is inching toward them. A flabby, middle-aged man in a bathrobe has begun to cut through the tables, looking as though he fears missing his bus to work. At the end of the nearest bench, a thin, old woman with streaming white hair stands up and beseeches Jack with her eyes. Her clasped, upraised hands tremble violently. Jack forces himself not to meet her eyes. When he passes her, she half croons, half whispers, "My ducky wucky was behind the door, but I didn't know it, and there he was in all that water." Fred says, "Judy told me her baby son drowned in the bath." Through the side of his eye, Jack has been watching the fuzzy-haired man in the bathrobe rush toward them, open-mouthed. When he and Fred reach the back of Judy Marshall's bench, the man raises one finger, as if signaling the bus to wait for him, and trots forward. Jack watches him approach, nuts to Warden Bond's advice. He's not going to let this lunatic climb all over him, no way. The upraised finger comes to within a foot of Jack's nose, and the man's murky eyes search his face. The eyes retreat, the mouth snaps shut. Instantly, the man whirls around and darts off, his robe flying, his finger still searching out its target. "What was that?" Jack wonders. "Wrong bus?" Judy Marshall has not moved. She must have heard the man rushing past her, his rapid breath when he stopped, then his flapping departure. But her back is still straight in the loose green robe, her head still faces forward at the same upright angle. She seems detached from everything around her. If her hair were washed, brushed, and combed, if she were conventionally dressed and had a suitcase beside her, she would look exactly like a woman on a bench at the train station waiting for the hour of departure. So even before Jack sees Judy Marshall's face, before she speaks a single word, there is about her this sense of leave-taking, of journeys begun and begun again, this suggestion of travel, this hint of a possible elsewhere. "I'll tell her we're here," Fred whispers, and ducks around the end of the bench to kneel in front of his wife. The back of her head tilts forward over the erect spine, as if to answer the tangled combination of heartbreak, love, and anxiety burning in her husband's handsome face. Dark blonde hair mingled with gold lies flat against the girlish curve of Judy Marshall's skull. Behind her ear, dozens of vari-colored strands clump together in a cobwebby knot. "How you feeling, sweetie?" Fred softly asks his wife. "I'm managing to enjoy myself," she says. "You know, honey, I should stay here for at least a little while. The head nurse is positive I'm absolutely crazy. Isn't that convenient?" "Jack Sawyer's here. Would you like to see him?" Judy reaches out and pats his upraised knee. "Tell Mr. Sawyer to come around in front, and you sit right here beside me, Fred." Jack is already coming forward, his eyes on Judy Marshall's once again upright head, which does not turn. Kneeling, Fred has taken her extended hand in both of his, as if he intends to kiss it. He looks like a lovelorn knight before a queen. When he presses her hand to his cheek, Jack sees the white gauze wrapped around the tips of her fingers. Judy's cheekbone comes into view, then the side of her gravely unsmiling mouth, then her entire profile is visible, as sharp as the crack of ice on the first day of spring. It is the regal, idealized profile on a cameo or on a coin. The slight upward curve of the lips, the crisp, chiseled downstroke of the nose, the sweep of the jawline, every angle in perfect, tender, in oddly familiar alignment with the whole. It staggers him, this unexpected beauty. For a fraction of a second, it slows him with the deep, grainy nostalgia of its fragmentary, not quite evocation of another's face. Grace Kelly, Catherine Deneuve? No. Neither of these. It comes to him that Judy's profile reminds him of someone he has still to meet.
Then the odd second passes. Fred Marshall gets to his feet. Judy's face in three-quarter profile loses its regal quality as she watches her husband sit beside her on the bench. And Jack rejects what has just occurred to him as an absurdity. She does not raise her eyes until he stands before her. Her hair is dull and messy. Beneath the hospital gown, she is wearing an old blue lace-trimmed nightdress that looked dowdy when it was new. Despite these disadvantages, Judy Marshall claims him for her own at the moment her eyes meet his. An electrical current, beginning at his optic nerves, seems to pulse downward through his body, and he helplessly concludes that she has to be the most stunningly beautiful woman he has ever seen. He fears that the force of his reaction to her will knock him off his feet. Then, even worse, that she will see what is going on and think him a fool. He desperately does not want to come off as a fool in her eyes. Brooke Greer, Claire Evinrude, Ileana Tedesco, gorgeous as each of them was in her own way, look like little girls in Halloween costumes next to her. Judy Marshall puts his former beloveds on the shelf. She exposes them as whims and fancies, riddled with false ego and 100 crippling insecurities. Judy's beauty is not put on in front of a mirror, but grows with breathtaking simplicity straight from her innermost being. What you see is only the small, visible portion of a far greater, more comprehensive, radiant, and formal quality within. Jack can scarcely believe that agreeable, good-hearted Fred Marshall actually had the fantastic luck to marry this woman. Does he know how great, how literally marvelous she is? Jack would marry her in an instant if she were single. It seems to him that he fell in love with her as soon as he saw the back of her head. But he cannot be in love with her. She is Fred Marshall's wife and the mother of their son, and he will simply have to live without her. She utters a short sentence that passes through him in a vibrating wave of sound. Jack bends forward, muttering an apology, and Judy smilingly offers him a sweep of her hand that invites him to sit before her. He folds to the floor and crosses his ankles in front of him, still reverberating from the shock of having first seen her. Her face fills beautifully with feeling. She has seen exactly what just happened to him, and it is all right. She does not think less of him for it. Jack opens his mouth to ask a question. Although he does not know what the question is to be, he must ask it. The nature of the question is unimportant. The most idiotic query will serve. He cannot sit here staring at that wondrous face. Before he speaks, one version of reality snaps soundlessly into another. And without transition, Judy Marshall becomes a tired-looking woman in her mid-30s, with tangled hair and smudges under her eyes, who regards him steadily from a bench in a locked mental ward. It should seem like a restoration of his sanity, but it feels instead like a kind of trick, as though Judy Marshall has done this herself to make their encounter easier on him. The words that escape him are as banal as he feared they might be. Jack listens to himself say that it is nice to meet her. "It's nice to meet you, too, Mr. Sawyer. I've heard so many wonderful things about you." He looks for a sign that she acknowledges the enormity of the moment that has just passed, but he sees only her smiling warmth. Under the circumstances, that seems like acknowledgment enough. "How are you getting on in here?" he asks, and the balance shifts even more in his direction. "The company takes some getting used to, but the people here got lost and couldn't find their way back, that's all. Some of them are very intelligent. I've had conversations in here that were a lot more interesting than the ones in my church group or the PTA. Maybe I should have come to Ward D sooner. Being here has helped me learn some things."
"Like what?"
"Like there are many different ways to get lost, for one. And getting lost is easier to do than anyone ever admits. The people in here can't hide how they feel, and most of them never found out how to deal with their fear."
"How are you supposed to deal with that?"
Why, you deal with it by taking it on, that's how. You don't just say, I'm lost and I don't know how to get back. You keep on going in the same direction. You put one foot in front of the other until you get more lost. Everybody should know that. Especially you, Jack Sawyer. Before he can finish the question, an elderly woman with a lined, sweet face appears beside him and touches his shoulder.
Excuse me.
She tucks her chin toward her throat with the shyness of a child.
I want to ask you a question. Are you my father?
Jack smiles at her. Let me ask you a question first. Is your name Estelle Packard? Eyes shining, the old woman nods. Then yes, I am your father. Estelle Packard clasps her hands in front of her mouth, dips her head in a bow, and shuffles backward, glowing with pleasure. When she is 9 or 10 feet away, she gives Jack a little bye-bye wave of one hand and twirls away. When Jack looks again at Judy Marshall, it is as if she has parted her veil of ordinariness just wide enough to reveal a small portion of her enormous soul.
You're a very nice man, aren't you, Jack Sawyer? I wouldn't have known that right away. You're a good man, too. Of course, you're also charming, but charm and decency don't always go together. Should I tell you a few other things about yourself?
Jack looks up at Fred, who is holding his wife's hand and beaming. I want you to say whatever you feel like saying.
There are things I can't say, no matter how I feel, but you might hear them anyhow. I can say this, however, your good looks haven't made you vain. You're not shallow, and that might have something to do with it. Mainly, though, you had the gift of a good upbringing. I'd say you had a wonderful mother. I'm right, aren't I?
Jack laughs, touched by this unexpected insight. I didn't know it showed.
You know one way it shows? In the way you treat other people. I'm pretty sure you come from a background people around here only know from the movies, but it hasn't gone to your head. You see us as people, not hicks, and that's why I know I can trust you. It's obvious that your mother did a great job. I was a good mother, too, or at least I tried to be, and I know what I'm talking about. I can see.
You say you were a good mother?
Why use the past tense? Because I was talking about before.
Fred's smile fades into an expression of ill-concealed concern.
What do you mean, before?
Mr. Sawyer might know, she says, giving Jack what he thinks is a look of encouragement.
Sorry, I don't think I do, he says.
I mean before I wound up here and finally started to think a little bit. Before the things that were happening to me stopped scaring me out of my mind. Before I realized I could look inside myself and examine these feelings I've had over and over all my life. Before I had time to travel. I think I'm still a good mother, but I'm not exactly the same mother.
Honey, please, says Fred, you are the same. You just had a kind of breakdown. We ought to talk about Tyler.
We are talking about Tyler. Mr. Sawyer, do you know that lookout point on Highway 93, right where it reaches the top of the big hill about a mile south of Arden?
I saw it today, Jack says. Fred showed it to me.
You saw all those farms that keep going and going, and the hills off in the distance?
Yes, Fred told me you loved the view from up there.
I always want to stop and get out of the car. I love everything about that view. You can see for miles and miles, and then, whoops, it stops, and you can't see any farther. But the sky keeps going, doesn't it? The sky proves that there's a world on the other side of those hills. If you travel, you can get there.
Yes, you can. Suddenly there are goosebumps on Jack's forearms, and the back of his neck is tingling.
Me? I can only travel in my mind, Mr. Sawyer, and I only remembered how to do that because I landed in the loony bin. But it came to me that you can get there, to the other side of the hills.
His mouth is dry. He registers Fred Marshall's growing distress without being able to reduce it. Wanting to ask her 1,000 questions, he begins with the simplest one. How did it come to you? What do you mean by that? Judy Marshall takes her hand from her husband and holds it out to Jack, and he holds it in both of his. If she ever looked like an ordinary woman, now is not the time. She is blazing away like a lighthouse, like a bonfire on a distant cliff.
Let's say, late at night, or if I was alone for a long time, someone used to whisper to me. It wasn't that concrete, but let's say it was as if a person were whispering on the other side of a thick wall. A girl like me. A girl my age. And if I fell asleep then, I would almost always dream about the place where that girl lived. I called it Faraway, and it was like this world, the Coolie Country, only brighter and cleaner and more magical. In Faraway, people rode in carriages and lived in great white tents. In Faraway, there were men who could fly.
You're right, he says. Fred looks from his wife to Jack in painful uncertainty, and Jack says, "It sounds crazy, but she's right."
By the time these bad things started to happen in French Landing, I had pretty much forgotten about Faraway. I hadn't thought about it since I was about 12 or 13. But the closer the bad things came to Fred and Ty and me, I mean, the worse my dreams got, and less real my life seemed to be. I wrote words without knowing I was doing it. I said crazy things. I was falling apart. I didn't understand that Faraway was trying to tell me something. The girl was whispering to me from the other side of the wall again. Only now she was grown up and scared half to death.
What made you think I could help?
It was just a feeling I had, back when you arrested that Kinderling man and your picture was in the paper. The first thing I thought when I looked at your picture was, he knows about Faraway. I didn't wonder how or how I could tell from looking at a picture. I simply understood that you knew. And then when Ty disappeared and I lost my mind and woke up in this place, I thought that if you could see into some of these people's heads, Ward D wouldn't be all that different from Faraway. And I remembered seeing your picture. And that's when I started to understand about traveling. All this morning, I have been walking through Faraway in my head, seeing it, touching it, smelling that unbelievable air. Did you know, Mr. Sawyer, that over there they have jackrabbits the size of kangaroos? It makes you laugh just to look at them.